summoned their angels and their lights, and my mighty voice is made to resound to the sixth heaven. In other words, the truth will be revealed to Christ's murderers by God's resounding voice that will be heard across all the seven levels of heaven, which, of course, is not what happens in the New Testament Gospels. No divine voice is heard across the world revealing Jesus' true identity, least of all to those who killed him. Yet here they, quote-unquote, become aware of who he is almost right away. What can only be meant here are the demons and demon princes who kill him in the firmament. Since they are the only ones who can be expected to hear this voice, along with their angels and lights, in other words, their subordinates, since men don't have angels and lights under them to summon. Nor did the killers of Jesus ever know Jesus was a divine being, yet here we are told they did, once God told them. This cannot mean the Jews and Romans. It can only mean Satan and his angelic princes. Therefore, chapter 10, verse 12 of this text clearly says those are his killers, not the humans interpolated into the story later in chapter 11. At any rate, before the final chapter, no one else but these demons is ever mentioned as being at all involved in this event, and no mention is ever made of Jesus going anywhere else but to the firmament to die. Only in the final chapter is the story suddenly changed and elaborated with all manner of details that are never even a component of God's original orders, as described in chapter 10, nor in the angel's account of God's plan to Isaiah in chapter 9, nor even plausibly concordant with them, both in terms of plot and literary style. Chapter 11, verses 2 to 22, clearly do not derive from the same author as the rest of chapter 6 through 11, as many experts do conclude. That this is confirmed in manuscript evidence only makes it all the more conclusive. This 11th chapter thus appears to have been redacted to include a complete earthly gospel story, as if it were what was being referred to in chapters 9 and 10, when that hardly makes sense. The two accounts don't fit each other at all. In line with this, two other key phrases also appear to have been interpolated. Quote, they will think that he is flesh and a man, end quote, and he shall, quote, descend in your form, end quote, are both missing from the Latin version. Although the Latin text is frequently abbreviated, that is unlikely to explain the coincidental omission of these specific phrases, the only statements outside the pocket gospel that refer to Jesus becoming a man. Nevertheless, those statements would still be compatible with a celestial event, as human sorcerers could fly into the air and be met with there, and earliest Christian belief certainly held that Jesus had assumed the form of a man so as to die, so we needn't rule them out. But if we conclude that the original text of the Ascension of Isaiah did not include most of the material currently found in chapter 11, but that the original text ended instead in a manner consistent with what is said in chapters 9 and 10, and indeed the repetitive nature of the text up to that point entails we should expect the conclusion to conform closely and repetitively to what chapters 9 and 10 say will happen, then we should first look to the manuscripts that omit this pocket gospel to see if there are any clues to what originally was there. This is what we see translating from the Latin text. After this, the angel said to me, understand, Isaiah, son of Amoz, because for this purpose have I been sent from God, that everything be revealed to you. For before you no one ever saw, nor after you will anyone be able to see what you have seen and heard. And I saw one like a son of man dwelling among men and in the world, and they did not know him. And I saw him ascend into the firmament, but he did not change himself into another form, and all the angels above the firmament saw him, and they worshipped him. This new version of chapter 11, verse 2, describes a kind of earthly sojourn, but in an absurdly brief fashion. This actually looks like a rewrite of the Jewish scripture of Baruch 3, verse 38, where God himself was, quote, seen on earth and conversed with men, end quote, which would sooner suggest a revelatory experience was going to be described. Hence, it's notable how this ascension text transforms Baruch. It does not have Jesus converse with men or seen by men, but has him only among men, yet completely unknown to them. Ascension of Isaiah 11, verse 2 also rewrites Daniel 7, verse 13, saying that what Isaiah saw was, quote, one like a son of man, end quote, the one who in Daniel appears among the clouds and will receive an eternal kingdom over the whole universe. But there is still something missing, and it's not the gospel that was later inserted. I suspect this version of chapter 11, verse 2 is closer to the original, but that it was followed by a more detailed description of what this meant and what happened, all as anticipated in chapters 9 and 10. That is now missing. Instead, in this version of the text, Jesus descends to the firmament, then to the lower air, and then is suddenly in the world among men, where he at last takes the form of a man, but no one knows him there. He then suddenly rises into the firmament in his original form and is only then seen by angels. Notably missing is what happened in between. Where is his execution, for example? Something has been removed. Not only are we missing the original story of Satan and his angels killing him, as we're told to expect in chapter 9, verse 14, but we also expect to hear an account of God's resounding voice across the heavens, since Isaiah had heard he would see that too, in chapter 10, verse 12. Likewise, an account of, quote, many of the righteous, end quote, ascending with Jesus, or in the Latin, being sent by Jesus, and Jesus hanging around for over a year, although this detail seems to have been abbreviated out of the Latin. Notably, none of these things are in the pocket gospel that was later inserted either, so that clearly was not what was removed from the original. Even Knight agrees something from the lost Greek original is missing from all extant manuscripts at this point. What had to have been in the original is the original gospel foretold in chapters 9 and 10, but that is not what is in any manuscript of the Ascension of Isaiah in chapters 10 and 11 now. Whatever was originally in the text at this point is lost to history, though possibly not entirely, as we'll see in chapter 8, section 6. Further evidence lies in the fact that in this version of the text, which is the same in the Latin and in the Slavonic, it is the angels above the firmament who first see Jesus in chapter 11, verses 23 to 24, with no mention of the angels in the firmament, whereas all the other manuscripts have Satan and his angels see him in the firmament, as we should expect. That has to be a mistranslation, since above the firmament defines the first heaven. Yet even in this text, the angels in the first heaven will worship him later in chapter 11, verses 25 to 26. So the text as written is confusing two different orders of angels. This also does not correspond to what God says Isaiah will see in chapter 10, verses 11 to 15, and chapter 10, verses 29 to 31. And of course, it makes no sense to skip over Satan and his angels at this point, as if suddenly they didn't exist, when we're told in chapter 10, verse 11, to expect a description of their surprise at this point. It would appear the redactor who produced this version of the text was trying to erase an account of Satan's reaction, and likewise that of the warring angels of the air and the firmament. He has likewise removed the account of God's celestial voice summoning the stars, and what Jesus did in the year and a half, or whatever period, before he ascended and was recognized, as we were told to expect in chapter 10, verses 12 to 15. Also deleted is any mention of the men Jesus was supposed to bring with him, in chapter 9, verse 17, or in the Latin, his sending of heralds throughout the earth. Undeniably, a lot has been removed, probably because it could not be gelled with the historicizing account embraced by later Christians who were preserving the text. A Jesus who is killed by Satan in the sky and then only appears to men in Revelations, as the citation of Baruch 3:38 implies was going to happen, had to be erased. One redactor just deleted it and tinkered a little with the then adjoining verses, the text that appears in the Latin and the Slavonic. While another just replaced it with a more desirable and orthodox gospel, which is the text that appears everywhere else. Given widespread evidence of Christian fabricating and tampering with texts, this should not be surprising, as I'll show in chapter 4 under element 44, and in chapter 7, section 7. But even if we imagine that the prior probability of either version of the 11th chapter of the Ascension of Isaiah being authentic is as low as 1 in 1,000, an a fortiori rate of interpolation in Christian texts, the evidence is so overwhelmingly improbable on the assumption of authenticity, 1,000,000 to 1 at best, that we can be certain what we have in that chapter now is not what was in the original. The original text cannot have been either A, the elaborate pocket gospel, which fails to correspond with the preceding material in too many ways to be even remotely likely, or B, the version that lacks that, but has, in its place, a completely different chapter 11, verse 2, and a revised chapter 11, verse 23, which not only flubs the sequence of events by deleting Jesus' expected glorious appearance to the angels of the firmament, and is implausibly brief, given the verbosity of the rest of the text, but also fails to contain any of the events that previous chapters told us would be recounted here. The defects of the inserted gospel are even greater than the defects of the version that fails to mention what we expect, and which not only fails to explain what happens after chapter 11, verse 2, but flubs chapter 11, verse 23. And thus, the one is even less probable on a theory of authenticity than the other. Yet in either case, the likelihood of having the text in the given state we have, if what we have is an unaltered text, is in my opinion no better than 1,000,000 to 1 against. With a prior probability of 1,000 to 1 the other way, that gets us odds of 1,000 to 1 in favor of my conclusion, that the text in both traditions is missing what it originally contained. Using the odds form of Bayes' theorem, the ratio between the probability that we are missing what was originally here, given the evidence, and the probability that we are not missing what was originally here, given the evidence, equals 1 in 1,000 times 1,000,001, which equals 1,000 to 1 odds that the original passage is now missing. Whether you share that conclusion or not, what is undeniable is that this text provides all the elements of a plausible theory. The narrative goes out of its way to explain that the firmament contains copies of everything on earth, which implies this fact is relevant to the subsequent narrative somehow, just as we shall see the same remark is in Hebrews, in chapter 11, section 5. It indisputably places Satan and his demons, the only princes and authorities and rulers and powers of which it speaks, in outer space, yet still in this world, distinctly below the first heaven, and thus in the recognized realm of flesh and corruption, as we'll see in element 35. And for two whole chapters, it belabors exclusively and at length the role and actions of these and only these powers in the crucifixion of Jesus on an unidentified tree. If we didn't have chapter 11, and certainly if this were also the only document describing Christian belief, we would conclude nothing else but that this Jesus Christ was being described as a pre-existent divine being descending below the moon to be killed by sky demons in outer space, because it then says nothing else. We have even more reason than that to be suspicious here, for the initial story told of Jesus in the ascension of Isaiah looks a lot like a story of another descending and ascending, dying and rising God, originating over 1,000 years before the Christian era. In the descent of Inanna, we are given a similarly repetitious account of a goddess, Inanna, variously otherwise known as Ishtar or Astarte, the very queen of heaven and daughter of God, who descends from the great above. Thus, abandoning heaven, she descends from outer space all the way past Earth into the realm of the dead below it, fully intending to be killed there and then resurrected 3 days later. Just like in the ascension of Isaiah, the narrative relates her plans in advance to ensure this, and then relates how it happens exactly to plan. And like the Jesus figure in the ascension of Isaiah, Inanna is crucified, nailed up, and notably not on Earth, but in a non-earthly realm, the sub-world, in accordance with Sumerian lore of the time. And not by people, but by demons and their godly overlords, who happen to be the gods of death, yet another coincidence with the ascension. And like the narrative that ends up in the Gospels, Inanna is also humiliated and condemned to death in a kind of kangaroo court. Most importantly, just as Jesus must descend through 7 levels of heaven, shedding layers of his glory at each stage and thereby humbling his appearance, which the ascension of Isaiah repeatedly equates with garments, so Inanna descends through 7 levels of the underworld, shedding layers of her regalia at each stage and thereby being humbled in her appearance, until at last she is naked, the most mortal and vulnerable state of all, and that's when she is killed. This is an extremely unlikely coincidence, particularly given the highly repetitious nature of both texts. It cannot be believed that the author of the Ascension, just by coincidence, ended up telling almost the very same story, right down to its characteristic repetitions, 7-stage descent and disrobing, crucifixion by demons, and resurrection. Inanna, like Jesus, was also God's child, and like the Ascension in the descent, her plans are explained before being described. There are many differences in these two tales, certainly. For instance, Inanna escapes the realm of the dead by trading places with her apparently haughty husband, Tammuz, who is dragged into hell by its demons. But the skeletal structure of the story in the Ascension clearly derives from this pre-Christian religion, whether by circuitous route or not. We know the Jews were long familiar with this sacred story of Inanna's descent. Jeremiah 7, verse 18 and 44, verses 15 to 26, complain of the prevalence of Inanna cult among Palestinian Jews, even in the heart of Jerusalem itself. And Ezekiel 8, verse 14, explicitly mentions women in Jerusalem weeping for the fate of Tammuz, which would be his dragging into hell at the behest of the resurrected Inanna, which ceremony is also known to have preceded the rejoicing at his own resurrection. Clearly the tale has instead been co-opted and improved by folding into it particularly Jewish and more modern religious notions. For instance, Jesus acts at the behest of the God Most High to ultimately overthrow Satan, and the descent is accomplished through levels of heaven rather than levels of hell. But that the story was changed to suit new and different sensibilities and purposes is precisely how religious syncretism works. Insufficient evidence survives to ascertain whether this is the root from which Christianity itself derived, but with this text, the evidence is undeniable that Christianity had merged its own myth with this pre-Christian dying and rising God concept very early and very thoroughly, because the ascension of Isaiah itself is unmistakably influenced by, and in outline derived from, the Inanna descent myth, whether directly or indirectly. And yet that myth already contains two elements supposedly distinctive of Jesus Christ as a dying and rising God: the humiliation, trial, and crucifixion of the worshipped divinity, and the resurrection in 3 days. And this is definitely what happens in their respective stories. After she is stripped naked and judgment is pronounced against her, Inanna is turned into a corpse, and the corpse was hung from a nail. And after 3 days and 3 nights, her assistants ask for her corpse and resurrect her. And Inanna arose, according to her plan, because she knew her father will surely bring me back to life, exactly as transpires. Indeed, there is a third parallel. Inanna's resurrection is secured by a ritual involving the divine food of life and the divine water of life. The Eucharist is only a few steps away. If all those elements are removed from Christianity, it's hard to think what could possibly remain that makes Jesus' historicity at all likely. If the Jesus of the Gospels wasn't humiliated, tried, and crucified, if he didn't originate the Eucharist, which is just another resurrection-securing ritual of food and drink, then the depth of myth-making that very rapidly surrounded him is truly extreme. And if it can be that extreme, why would we balk at the idea that the rest is myth too? In one of the earliest Christian texts we have, the Apostle Paul says God's plan of Christ's death-defeating sacrifice was a secret kept hidden, and only recently known by revelation, such that none of the rulers of this world knew, for had they known it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. This looks like a direct paraphrase of an early version of the Ascension of Isaiah, wherein Jesus is also the Lord of glory, his descent and divine plan is also hidden, and the rulers of this world are indeed the ones who crucify him in ignorance of that hidden plan. It even has an angel predict his resurrection on the third day, and the Latin and Slavonic contains a verse that Paul actually cites as scripture in the very same place. So is Paul here referring to the demonic execution of Jesus in outer space? That would certainly explain why he would say this cannot have been seen by anyone, but is known only by revelation. That this makes particular sense, in fact, more sense than what's usually assumed, is what I shall argue in chapter 11. Here, my aim is not to argue that this theory is true, but to explain what this theory is. Section 2. The Basic Problem. There is a large array of books and scholars who have advanced various Jesus myth theories over the last 2 centuries. A historicist might complain that there are too many different theories being advanced, but that would only be the pot calling the kettle black. As I discussed in the previous chapter, and in chapter 1 of Proving History, there are, for example, too many different theories of historicity as well. And if those are taken seriously, the fact that mythicism finds the same diversity of disagreement can be no objection to it, any more than it would be a valid objection to historicity. We must agree that most theories of historicity are false, since only one of the hundreds defended can actually be correct. Yet, historicity might still be true. So, too, mythicism. I won't explore the many flawed or ridiculous Jesus myth theories that have gone around or still circulate. I will only mention here the most credible defenses of mythicism, ranked in order of the extent to which they hold to the rules and axioms I summarized in Chapter 2 of Proving History. At the top of that list is Erhold Doherty's The Jesus Puzzle, Did Christianity Begin with a Mythical Christ? And his follow-up, Jesus, Neither God Nor Man, The Case for a Mythical Jesus. Complete, of course, with an extensive website in support of both at jesuspuzzle.humanists.net. I recommend a reader start with the first of those and treat the others as an appendix to it. Meanwhile, the most prestigious support for myth, coming from renowned doctors of biblical studies, are Thomas Thompson's The Messiah Myth, The Near Eastern Roots of Jesus and David, and Thomas Brodie's Beyond the Quest for the Historical Jesus, A Memoir of a Discovery. Whether some very insignificant Jesus might still lay at the origin of Christianity is a question Thompson considers unanswerable, but he still argues that the Gospels are fiction top to bottom, leaving nothing left that we can consider a historical Jesus. Arthur Droege, professor of early Christianity at the University of California, San Diego, and Kurt Knoll, associate professor of religion at Brandon University, agree with that agnostic assessment. Brodie only takes this to its natural conclusion, that originally there was no Jesus at all. So Doherty is not alone. Another PhD in the field making the case is Robert Price, with a whole series of books on the matter, from Deconstructing Jesus and The Incredible Shrinking Son of Man to Jesus is Dead and The Case Against the Case for Christ, and most recently and most valuably, The Christ Myth Theory and Its Problems. Price's efforts have been more controversial and are often more debatable, but nevertheless, much of what he says has enough merit to at least consider, even if you reject it in the end. Among the controversies he has created is his tendency to advance and defend multiple contradictory accounts of the evidence, although that's in many ways more honest than what historicists do, since Price fully acknowledges the evidence is insufficient to confirm only one theory, and therefore many compete for viability. And in effect, this is what historicists tacitly assume in accepting, even if themselves rejecting, the many contradictory theories of their colleagues without scandal. Before this new vanguard of scholars arose, the most famous recent defender of the Jesus myth was George Wells, with over half a dozen books spanning 40 years from Did Jesus Exist in 1975 to Cutting Jesus Down to Size in 2009. His approach has evolved into essentially the position of Thompson, that there may yet be a historical Jesus behind it all, but there simply isn't sufficient evidence to know, as everything claiming to be about him is fiction. I place Wells near the bottom of my list of worthies because his competence in ancient history is not overly strong, and thus, although he has a lot of sound points to make, some of his premises and conclusions become untenable in light of background facts unknown to him. Before Wells, the very best outdated defense of the Jesus myth concept is Arthur Drews's The Christ Myth, published in 1910, which, despite its flaws, still has many sound points to make that are as true today as they were then. I could name other advocates now and in the past who may have worthwhile things to say in the matter, but as they often fall below acceptable bars of reliability or scholarly qualifications, they cannot contribute as much toward changing the scholarly consensus at this point. As with the historicists, I do not believe any one of the scholars I've named is quote-unquote right, but that the truth lies somewhere among them all. Just as one would not read, say, Robert Eisenman's James the Brother of Jesus, The Key to Unlocking the Secrets of Early Christianity and the Dead Sea Scrolls, and conclude, this is erudite and interesting, but complete bollocks, therefore Jesus didn't exist. So one should not read any particular mythicist and likewise conclude, this is erudite and interesting, but complete bollocks, therefore Jesus did exist. We all accept that every historicist is probably wrong about something, possibly quite a lot of things. They must be, as they all disagree. But we do not then conclude historicity is bunk. We conclude the truth lies somewhere among them all. We should approach mythicism the same way. Historicists will usually agree that once we trim away everything that's wrong or too speculative or inadequately demonstrated, we'll have something that can be reliably affirmed about the historical Jesus, even if it's literally nothing more than that he existed. And if this is how we behave in reaction to the contradictions and errors among historicists, and we must, as otherwise only a complete agnosticism about the historical Jesus would logically remain, we are obligated to behave the same in reaction to the contradictions and errors among mythicists. As for historicists, so for them. Once we trim away everything that's wrong or too speculative or inadequately demonstrated, we may yet have something that can be reliably affirmed about the historical Jesus, even if only that he didn't exist, or that we can't reliably know that he did. The same point can be expanded beyond the mainstream, for there are as many absurd theories of historicity as there are absurd Jesus myth theories. That Jesus toured India, or flew to North America, or exchanged letters with King Abgar, or convinced King Agrippa to back him on state currency as the Messiah, or that Jesus fathered a royal dynasty with Mary, and then his kin had to dodge imperial attempts to eliminate their bloodline, or that he staged all his miracles, including faking his death and resurrection, simply to set himself up as king of the Jews, which plan then failed, or that the canonical gospels are literally and entirely true down to the smallest detail. These are all theories of historicity that I must honestly say are extraordinarily untenable. Yet all have been advanced and defended by scholars somewhere at some time. The last of these especially, which even today has whole colleges pledged to defending it. So finding equally absurd theories among the mythicists is no more a strike against mythicism as the above theories are against historicity. We simply set them aside as not worth even considering, leaving only the tenable theories to entertain. As for historicity, so for myth. To avoid the monstrous task of a complete fact check of every mythicist book I've listed, which books I consider to be advancing tenable theories, just not necessarily the correct ones, I will take the obvious shortcut. I won't bother defending any of the elaborations or specific but unnecessary claims of any author. I will instead construct the most minimal, plausible Jesus myth theory and see how it holds up. As with the minimal theory of historicity, defined in the previous chapter, there may yet be much else we can show to be true. But before we can proceed down that path, we must first settle the basic question of whether we ought to be interpreting the evidence with the assumption that a historical Jesus existed or that he did not. Hence, I'll pit minimal historicity against minimal mythicism, and see which has the greater merit in the final analysis. Other scholars can then build on that conclusion, which is what should have been done in the first place. Indeed, I see this as one of the greatest methodological mistakes of mythicists. Instead of first convincing the establishment of the basic merits of their interpretational framework, and then recruiting the scholarly community in developing further conclusions therefrom, they immediately launch with elaborate conclusions about everything, making their theory all too easy to strawman into the dustbin. And that's essentially what's happened. In Chapter 1, I already discussed Van Voorst, who, in a few pages, directly rebuts mythicism, though really just Drews and Wells, and cited Thyssen and Mertz, who summarize a lengthier case against many generic mythicist claims. But only the weakest premises, and they never directly interact with any specific mythicist thesis. Other examples of recent criticism likewise touch only on some aspects of mythicism, and often inaccurately. And yet, these are the only scholarly attempts to refute mythicism worth reading, with the exception of several very outdated but still noteworthy works, which reveal, in their very efforts to rebut it, how popular was the idea, even among some experts of the time, that Jesus was a myth. All are examples of the inadequacy of scholarly responses even from the earliest days of the controversy. In fact, the assumption that mythicism has been refuted rests entirely on a series of fallacious rebuttals merely assumed to have been decisive. Shirley Jackson Case, for instance, soundly rebuts only certain mythicist arguments. That Case, and everyone afterward, concluded mythicism itself had thus been soundly rebutted is simply incorrect. We'll revisit this point in Chapter 11. Early mythicism of the sort Case documents was launched from many sound intuitions that remained forceful, but was often flawed and naive, and certainly methodologically unsound, as is a lot of myth advocacy still today. And all the early 20th century critics remain quite right about that. Accordingly, we need to wipe the slate clean and start over, using a humbler, more informed, and more methodologically sound approach. Only if that effort then fails, without being made into a straw man all over again, can it be concluded that mythicism tut court has been refuted. And then we can get on with the study of the historical Jesus. Section 3. The Minimal Jesus Myth Theory. Despite countless variations, including a still rampant obsession with indemonstrable astrological theories of gospel interpretation that you won't find much sympathy for here. The basic thesis of every competent mythicist, then and now, has always been that Jesus was originally a god, just like any other god. Properly speaking, a demigod in pagan terms, an archangel in Jewish terms. In either sense, a deity. Who was later historicized, just as countless other gods were. And that the Gospel of Mark, or Mark's source, originated the Christian myth familiar to us by building up an edifying and symbolically meaningful tale for Jesus, drawing on passages from the Old Testament and popular literature, coupled with elements of revelation and pious inspiration. The manner in which Osiris came to be historicized, moving from being just a cosmic god to being given a whole narrative biography set in Egypt during a specific historical period, complete with collections of wisdom sayings he supposedly uttered, is still an apt model, if not by any means an exact one. Which is to say, it establishes a proof of concept. It is, in essence, what all mythicists are saying happened to Jesus. Distilling all of this down to its most basic principles, we get the following set of propositions. Number one, at the origin of Christianity, Jesus Christ was thought to be a celestial deity much like any other. Number two, like many other celestial deities, this Jesus communicated with his subjects only through dreams, visions, and other forms of divine inspiration, such as prophecy, past and present. Number three, like some other celestial deities, this Jesus was originally believed to have endured an ordeal of incarnation, death, burial, and resurrection in a supernatural realm. Number four, as for many other celestial deities, an allegorical story of this same Jesus was then composed and told within the sacred community, which placed him on earth in history as a divine man, with an earthly family, companions, and enemies, complete with deeds and sayings, and an earthly depiction of his ordeals. Number five, subsequent communities of worshippers believed, or at least taught, that this invented sacred story was real and either not allegorical or only additionally allegorical. That all five of those propositions are true shall be my minimal Jesus myth theory. As occasion warrants, I might add features on to test the merits of more complex theories, but unless I explicitly say otherwise, what I've just enumerated is the theory I shall be testing against the minimal theory of historicity. Because if any one of the first four premises is false, it can fairly be said Jesus did not begin his life in myth, he just ended up there. And at least one of those premises must be false, for Jesus was a real historical man, to be a relevantly true statement. The fifth premise, however, is uncontroversially a given, being already compatible with historicity and well enough confirmed in the evidence as to not be in doubt. Unlike the minimal theory of historicity, however, what I have just said is not strictly entailed. If, for example, Jesus Christ began as a celestial deity is false, it could still be that he began as a political fiction, for example, as some scholars have indeed argued, the best examples being R.G. Price and Gary Courtney. But as will become clear in the following chapters, especially chapter 11, such a premise has a much lower prior probability, and thus is already at a huge disadvantage over premise 1, even before we start examining the evidence. And it has a very low consequent probability. Though it suits the Gospels well, it just isn't possible to explain the evidence in the epistles this way, and the origin of Christianity itself becomes very hard to explain as well. Although I leave open the possibility it may yet be vindicated, I'm sure it's very unlikely to be, and accordingly I will assume its prior probability is too small even to show up in our math. This decision can be reversed only by a sound and valid demonstration that we must assign it a higher prior or consequent. But that I leave to anyone who thinks it's possible. In the meantime, what we have left is what I described as premise one, such that if that is less probable than minimal historicity, then I would be convinced historicity should be affirmed, particularly as the political fiction theory already fits historicity and thus is not really a challenge to it. Indeed, that's often the very kind of fiction that gets written about historical persons. This same conclusion follows for premise two, which could also be false and mythicism still be true, but only on the alternative hypothesis that everything said about, and said to have been said by, Jesus, was an outright and deliberate fabrication, or the product of such a deranged reading of scripture as to beg every question of why the movement would even have found followers, which again has a very low prior probability, certainly much lower by far than what I have described as premise 2. And it also has a very low consequent probability, given, again, all the evidence in the epistles, as well as the background knowledge that I will survey in chapters 4 and 5. Of course, by premise 2, I do not mean to assert that this celestial Christ really did communicate with people by such supernatural means, only that this is what the original Christian founders sincerely believed was happening, or at the very least, claimed was happening. Likewise, I am not here saying there wasn't a lot that was deliberately and thus deceitfully made up about what Jesus said and did. As most mainstream scholars would agree, a lot certainly was, but that all of it would be is what I deem too improbable to credit. Premises 3 and 4 could similarly be denied and mythicism still be true, so long as we posited that the founders of Christianity hallucinated the entire life and fate of an earthly Christ, or outright lied about it ever having occurred. But again, either possibility has an extremely low prior probability, and though it may command a high consequent probability, since lies and hallucinations often look exactly the same as the truth, that's in fact why they are ever believed in the first place, I suspect it would entail a lower consequent probability than what I have described as premises 3 and 4, or at best, none better. Perhaps such a theory can still claim a higher consequent probability than historicity, but I doubt that, and in any case, that's someone else's business to prove. More to the point, even if such a theory were sustained, I suspect it would still end up with a lower posterior probability than would result from premises 3 and 4, so the merits of such a theory would be moot. It would still be false, and the theory here defended true instead. In any case, it's the extremely small prior probability of these alternatives that matters for the moment, because that means they take up so little of the prior probability space that we can safely ignore them. Finally, premise 5 is already an effective certainty, as it is true even if historicity is true, and is so well verified in background evidence that its prior probability is as near to 100% as makes all odds. So the possibility of its being false will not be an issue. Since premise 5 is certainly true, and the prior probability of any of premises 1 through 4 being false and historicity still not being true is vanishingly small, certainly less than a tenth of 1% by any reasonable estimate, if I assign not H to be the theory defined by premises 1 through 5, I can safely assume that H entails historicity, given my minimal definition of historicity as a hypothesis in chapter 2, and that these exhaust all relevant possibilities, and therefore I have a proper binary test, H against not H. Just two hypotheses to compare against each other, such that if one is false, the other is true. Certainly, when framed like this, technically not H, or non-historicity, must also include all Jesus myth theories not defined by premises 1 through 5, that is, all theories of the evidence for Jesus that entail historicity as false, and at least one of premises 1 through 5 is false. But since their prior probability, even collectively, is surely less than a tenth of 1%, as I have just reasoned, and their posterior probability not sufficiently high to make enough of a difference, especially in relation to minimal historicity, these theories share such a small portion of the probability space occupied by not H that they can simply be ignored. In other words, if not H, as I have minimally defined it, is false, it's simply the case that historicity is probably true. With both the hypotheses of historicity and myth duly defined, now we must turn to a survey of the essential background knowledge governing their comparison. Chapter 4. Background Knowledge Relating to Christianity. Section 1. A Romulan Tale. In Plutarch's biography of Romulus, the founder of Rome, we are told he was the son of God, born of a virgin. An attempt is made to kill him as a baby, and he is saved and raised by a poor family, becoming a lowly shepherd. Then as a man he becomes beloved by the people, hailed as king, and killed by the conniving elite. Then he rises from the dead, appears to a friend to tell the good news to his people, and ascends to heaven to rule from on high, just like Jesus. Plutarch also tells us about annual public ceremonies that were still being performed, which celebrated the day Romulus ascended to heaven. The sacred story told at this event went basically as follows. At the end of his life, amid rumors he was murdered by a conspiracy of the Senate, just as Jesus was murdered by a conspiracy of the Jews, in fact, by the Sanhedrin, the Jewish equivalent of the Senate, the sun went dark, just as it did when Jesus died, and Romulus's body vanished, just as Jesus's did. The people wanted to search for him, but the Senate told them not to, for he had risen to join the gods, much as a mysterious young man tells the women in Mark's gospel. Most went away happy, hoping for good things from their new god, but, quote-unquote, some doubted, just as all later gospels say of Jesus. Just look at Matthew 28, verse 17, Luke 24, verse 11, John 20, verses 24 to 25. Even Mark 16, verse 8 implies this. Soon after, Proculus, a close friend of Romulus, reported that he met Romulus on the road between Rome and a nearby town and asked him, "Why have you abandoned us?" To which Romulus replied that he had been a god all along, but had come down to earth and become incarnate to establish a great kingdom, and now had to return to his home in heaven, pretty much as happens to Cleopas in Luke 24, verses 13 to 32. We'll see more about that in chapter 10. Then Romulus told his friend to tell the Romans that if they are virtuous, they will have all worldly power. Luke converts this glorious appearance tale into a hidden god narrative, a reversal that befits how Christianity was also inverting the message of Romulus, promising, at least in the meantime, a hidden spiritual kingdom rather than a visible earthly one. But otherwise, the details are essentially the same. In fact, the similarities are even more numerous than I've proposed here, as I'll show in chapter 10 and earlier in chapter 5. Plutarch tells us that the annual Roman ceremony of the Romulan ascent involved a recitation of the names of those who fled his vanishing in fear, and the acting out of their fear and flight in public, a scene suspiciously paralleling the pre-redacted ending of Mark's Gospel at 16 verse 8, which would make sense of his otherwise bizarre ending. We are then to assume what followed his story is just what followed the story he is emulating, an appearance of the Lord delivering the gospel, which is then proclaimed to the people, the very thing Mark tells us to anticipate in chapter 14, verse 28, and chapter 16, verse 7. In fact, Livy's account, just like Mark's, emphasizes that fear and bereavement kept the people silent for a long time, and only later did they proclaim Romulus God, Son of God, King, and Father, thus matching Mark's "they said nothing to anyone," yet obviously assuming that somehow word got out. It certainly seems as if Mark is fashioning Jesus into the new Romulus, with a new superior message, establishing a new superior kingdom. This Romulan tale looks a lot like a skeletal model for the Passion narrative, a great man, founder of a great kingdom, despite coming from lowly origins and of suspect parentage, is actually an incarnated son of God, but dies as a result of a conspiracy of the ruling council, then a darkness covers the land at his death and his body vanishes, at which those who followed him flee in fear, just like the gospel women in Mark 16, 8, and the gospel men in Mark 14, verses 50 to 52. And like them, too, we look for his body, but are told he is not here, he has risen. And some doubt, but then the risen God appears to select followers to deliver his gospel. There are many differences in the two stories, surely, but the similarities are too numerous to be a coincidence, and the differences are likely deliberate. For instance, Romulus's material kingdom favoring the mighty is transformed into a spiritual one favoring the humble. It certainly looks like the Christian Passion narrative is an intentional transvaluation of the Roman Empire's ceremony of their own founding savior's incarnation, death, and resurrection. Other elements have been added to the Gospels, the story heavily Judaized, and many other symbols and motifs pulled in to transform it. And the narrative has been modified in structure and content to suit the Christians' own moral and spiritual agenda. But the basic structure is not original. There were, in fact, numerous pre-Christian savior gods who became incarnate and underwent sufferings or trials, even deaths and resurrections. None of them actually existed. Neither did Romulus. Yet all were placed in history and often given detailed biographies, just like Plutarch's. Section 2. Background Knowledge. We cannot claim to understand the Christian religion and its documents if we ignore such background knowledge as this. We cannot estimate what was likely or typical, unless we know everything relevant we can know about the context of the time, including comparative evidence from religions and movements of that time and place, and religions and movements throughout history. Knowing the background of the Romulus myths and rituals drastically changes what we will consider possible or likely in the case of Jesus, and yet that's just one single item. Think how much difference will be made by knowing 100 such items. We also cannot arrive at accurate judgments if we ignore all the data we actually have from Christianity's earliest documents. Yet many scholars ignore a surprising amount of that data when formulating theories and estimates of likelihood. We can't do that. We need to attend to as complete and secure a body of background knowledge as possible so we can correctly condition all our probability estimates on it, as Bayes' theorem requires. We also have to take into account how much we don't know about antiquity, because assuming we know everything is itself a fallacy that undermines many theories and estimates. Background knowledge should consist of facts beyond reasonable dispute. Some of these facts are theoretical, but are so well established from the facts available that we can treat them as tantamount to established facts. Most of this body of material is not specific to Christianity, for example, the laws of physics. And most that is specific to Christianity is, or ought to be, already well known by experts in Jesus studies, which is why experts are more qualified to judge theories in ancient history. A thorough knowledge of the evidence and contextual background is necessary to make credible estimates of likelihood. I've already said enough about this in Chapter 2 of Proving History. But the point is, no one can be an expert in everything, and evaluating claims about Jesus requires understanding the modern science of hallucination and psychosomatic illness, as well as the established findings of modern sociology, psychology, and cultural anthropology. But even some of the historical material is surprisingly not known to many experts. I have selected the most important of those elements to present here, which will play a significant part in evaluating the remaining evidence in following chapters. In fact, everything here to follow is what any theory of the origins of Christianity must fit and take into account. For what follows is true, regardless of whether Jesus existed as a historical person or not. Hence, even a historical Jesus can only be understood in this context. As I explained in Proving History, in science, usually background knowledge, or B, includes all previous data, while evidence, or E, is limited to new data from a single experiment or study. History only occasionally gets new data. What historians are keen to know is not just whether new data changes what we should believe, but more often, what a particular body of evidence warrants believing. And historians examine both questions in terms of causal explanation. Determining what happened, the events of history, is a function of determining what caused the evidence we now have. And determining why that happened requires determining what caused the events thus discerned. I provided all the logical demonstrations and explanations of these points in Proving History. Thus, what goes in E is ordinarily what historians believe stands in need of a causal explanation. The question they ask is, how did that evidence come about? Everything else goes in B. Data can be moved between these two sets however you desire, as long as you are consistent. For example, what you put in E stays in E throughout a single equation. That this demarcation is arbitrary makes no difference to the method, since the mathematics must work out the same. If it doesn't, you've made a mistake somewhere. Thus, some of what follows could be moved from B to E if you so desired, but doing so can make no difference to the final outcome. Section 3. Elemental Definitions. I must first define some terms I will frequently use. Other terms I define as I present them, including a few already in Chapter 1. These definitions are not intended to be normative, so there is no sense in arguing whether my definitions are right or wrong. They merely specify what I mean when I use those terms, regardless of what anyone else might mean, or what any dictionaries say, or any other conventions. As long as you treat my definitions as nothing more than explanations of what I mean, confusion will be forestalled. I shall use God, lowercase, to mean any celestial being with supernatural power, and God, uppercase, to mean a supreme creator deity. Though by this definition, angels and demons are indeed gods, lowercase. I'll sometimes, but not always, use angel or archangel to refer to gods, lowercase, that are believed to be acting as messengers or servants of God, uppercase. And demon, to refer to gods, lowercase, who are believed to be acting in opposition to God, uppercase. The terminology was already this fluid, even among early Christians. For example, just look at 2 Corinthians 4, verse 4, 1 Corinthians 8, verse 5, or Galatians 4, verses 8 to 9. Although I will also on occasion use demon more neutrally in the context of pagan belief, in which there were both good and evil demons, all of whom gods in the lowercase. I shall mean by Jesus Christ, meanwhile, the name given by the earliest known Christians to a man who is believed to have historically existed, whether on earth or only in heaven or both, and who have in some sense originated the Christian religion. For the meaning of his name, go back to chapter 6, section 2. I shall mean by Christianity and all cognate terms, any cult venerating this Jesus Christ as a divine being. And by cult, of course, I do not mean the pejorative, but the standard anthropological term for any community of worship distinguished by a system of religious rituals and doctrines. I shall mean by Messiah, the Hebrew word of which Christ is a translation, any man, in fact, myth, or prophecy, who is A, anointed by the Hebrew God, to B, play a part in God's plan to liberate his chosen people from their oppressors, and C, restore or institute God's true religion. This means anointed in any sense then understood, literally, figuratively, cosmically, or symbolically, and liberate in any sense then claimed, physically or spiritually. Also oppressors in any sense then identified, whoever or whatever they may be, and religion in the fullest sense, cult, mores, sacred knowledge, and the resulting social order. And I specify only play a part, not necessarily bring to fruition. All Jewish kings and high priests were, of course, messiahs in the basic sense of being anointed to represent God. But here I shall mean a messiah conforming to A through C. Yet I do not assume there must be only one messiah of that kind, and neither did the Jews, as I'll show in elements 3 and 4 shortly. I've seen some scholars question or deny that the Jews had any prior notion of a messiah before the advent of Christianity, but such a denial is accomplished only by proposing an implausibly hyperspecific definition of messiah, then showing no such thing was previously imagined, and concluding, quote, the Jews had no prior notion of a messiah, end quote. This is a textbook fallacy of equivocation. Start with a term defined one way, then end with the same term defined in a completely different way, often without noticing a switch has been made. To avoid this, I shall stick to my minimal definition, since I am certain anyone meeting criteria A, B, and C would have been regarded by at least some ancient Jews or Judaizers as a messiah. I attach no other baggage to the term, no particular eschatology or scheme of liberation. Jews of antiquity were clearly quite flexible in all such details, as everyone agrees, as I'll show for element 2. I shall mean by crucifixion, meanwhile, and being crucified and all other cognate terms and phrases, as any hanging up of the living or dead as a punishment, regardless of the exact details of how. The shape of the cross or fixture, the position of the body, whether the victim is killed first or hung while alive and left to die, even the manner of hanging, whether nailing or lashing, or whether to a rock or tree or stake or doorway or anything else, all of that can and certainly did vary, and yet the act still constitutes crucifixion if, A, a body is hanged by anything other than a noose around the neck, and B, this hanging is a punishment. Even the ancient terminology was no more specific than that. In fact, it was less so. Hence, I see no valid reason ours should be. For example, the Bible described one method of execution as to, quote-unquote, hang in the sun. In the Septuagint, literally, exhaliasdo, in other words, exhaliu, out in the sun, or apananti tu helio, against the sun, which implies the intent was for the hanged to die from exposure. Just look at Numbers 25, verse 4, and 2 Samuel 21, verses 6, 9, and 13. That is essentially a form of crucifixion, however it was affected. Likewise, when Joshua hung on trees the king of Ai and the kings of the Amorites in Joshua 8, verse 29 and 10, verses 26 to 27, and when the law of Moses calls for the executed to be hanged on trees or planks, xulon in the Greek, even when already dead, in Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 to 23, or when Haman and his sons are hung on a giant pole, xulon again in Greek translations of Esther 5, verse 14, 7, verses 9 to 10, and 8, verse 7. These are all forms of crucifixion. Many scholars of Jewish antiquity now agree. In using the term crucifixion this way, I do not mean to rule out finer distinctions for those who want to make them. Someone else, for example, may want to restrict the term to an actual means of killing, thus including only those hung up alive to die, rather than the hanging of corpses. But since I see no contradiction in the idea of crucifying a corpse, and the ancient terminology does not exclude it, I think such a restriction is too fastidious. Since there was no standard practice of crucifixion even among the Romans, we can't be sure if everyone they crucified was nailed, or merely tied up, or even impaled, or exactly where, or how, or to what. If we are too particular, we will anachronistically exceed the ideas and vocabulary of the period. The Greek word for crucify, starao, literally means staked or palisaded, and frequently meant not just crucified but also impaled, or even setting up spiked walls around a fort. Hence, to stake, starao, someone on a pole, xulon, is what happens in the early Greek translation of Esther 7 verse 9, using the exact same verb used of the crucifixion of Jesus in the New Testament, as well as the exact same word for post or tree used in the Septuagint text of the Old Torah Law, that passage in Deuteronomy, which is also the same word used for the cross and crucifixion of Jesus in the New Testament. Thus, as the ambiguity existed then, I preserve it myself. I shall mean by resurrection, and all similar terms, any restoration of life to the dead, whether permanent or not, though I shall distinguish when the term is used literally or figuratively. Merely the survival or ascension of an already immortal soul does not count as a restoration in this sense, and thus is not a resurrection. But abandoning the corpse altogether and rising to life in a completely new body does count, and thus is a resurrection. As with the term Messiah, I've seen recent attempts to claim that pagans had no notion of resurrection, again by producing a hyper-specific definition of one particular kind of resurrection, proving they didn't have or accept it, then concluding they had no notion of resurrection at all. But such specificity did not exist in ancient vocabulary. Many different Jewish and Christian sects believed in many different kinds of resurrection, and all were called resurrection. And there were yet more kinds of resurrection imagined among the pagans, and considerable overlap between their ideas and those of the Jews and Christians. I shall thus avoid any fallacy of anachronistic precision by using all words for resurrection to mean just what they meant to everyone in antiquity, whether pagan, Jew, or Christian, arising from a state of death to be alive again, nothing more. I shall mean by outer space everything above the atmosphere as presently known. In ancient understanding, this included A, everything in or under the firmament, also known as the air or sublunar sphere, extending above the highest visible clouds all the way to the orbit of the moon, and B, all the heavens beyond, also then known as the ether or ethereal realm. The notion that any of this region may have been a vacuum did exist at the time, but only as a controversial theory rejected by most religious cosmologists, and only embraced typically by atomists and others generally hostile to the supernatural. Most people of the time thought the air extended all the way to the moon, while everything beyond that was filled with a breathable ether, when in fact, as we now know, the real atmosphere extends only a minuscule fraction of that distance. So when they spoke of beings and events in the air, quote-unquote, they were often speaking of what we mean by outer space. This is even more obvious when they spoke of beings and events in the spheres of heaven above the moon. Accordingly, if an ancient author was speaking of what we would call outer space, I will say outer space. This does not mean I attribute to them a modern knowledge of the extraterrestrial vacuum. It only means They were thinking of realms beyond the terrestrial domains of mountains, clouds, and birds. For it was already common knowledge among the educated of the time that the moon's distance from the Earth was hundreds of thousands of miles. So when they used terms that we often translate as air, they were often not referring to what we mean by the air today, but a far more vast and frightening realm of fantastic possibilities, which many thought was trafficked by gods and filled with strange animals or spirits. I shall use gospel for the general idea of the quote-unquote